It has been 28 years since a guy named John McClane met a guy named Hans Gruber. And here's one of their early conversations.
But you have me at a loss. You know my name, but who are you?
Just another American who saw too many movies as a child. Another orphan of a bankrupt culture who thinks he's John Wayne, Rambo, Marshall Dillon.
I was always kind of partial to Roy Rogers, actually. I really like those sequin shirts.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay.
Okay, cut it off right there, because we can't include the last word of that, which when it was originally broadcast on TV was yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon, and then changed to yippee-ki-yay, my friend. The movie, of course, is Die Hard, and that's Alan Rickman and the star of the movie, Bruce Willis. I'm playing it for you today because my next guest has written oral history of Die Hard. It's available now as a Kindle single. His name is Brian Abrams. Hi, Brian. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you? I had no idea about the Mr. Falcon TV censored line. Amazing.
That was the first time it ever aired. Nowadays, of course, they either cut it out completely or make it my friend. I didn't know until I read your oral history of Die Hard that in the original book that the movie is based on, John McClane dies.
Well, yeah, there's interestingly enough, in the original manuscript for the book, 1 year before it was unpublished, McClane's character dies, and then they had fixed it by then, by the time it hit the bookshelves. But even when that book called Nothing Lasts Forever, written by this guy named Roderick Thorpe, who at that point, that was his like ninth crime novel, it was so filled with all these depressing elements that you wouldn't even be able to detect in the movie that eventually, you know, hit the screen 9 years later. Not only was there that sort of hurdle that they jumped about making sure that McClane survived, but in the initial book, Holly McClane, who was played by, you know, Bonnie Bedelia in the movie, that character was actually his daughter, because the lead hero was a widow, and at the end of the book, the daughter falls off the top of the building with the lead terrorist. There were children that were hostages that get killed. I mean, it was such a depressing book. It's so amazing to see this kind of constellation over the years, over this decade, of how this movie got made and how it was once this really sad character study and all of a sudden became, you know, kind of a pseudo comedy action, you know, blockbuster hit.
Yeah. This happens a lot when books are taken and turned into movies, particularly if the author is kind of pushed aside. Look, here's a check, go away. I remember the movie The Natural that Barry Levinson made. In the book, Roy Hobbs does not hit the big home run. It's a really depressing ending to the book, but you can't have a Robert Redford movie end on a depressing note. He's got to win the big game. And in Die Hard, Bruce Willis's character has to kill the terrorist and save his wife.
It is amazing, isn't it, how the universes are different? I mean, you would think on some level that the book world might have that as well. They want to sell copies too. But I guess when, you know, I think, you know, writing a book is obviously a way more private experience and project, whereas a movie is made by consortium, right? So you have a lot of people chiming in with their notes, and by the time it's all said and done, yeah, everyone's hitting the home run and surviving, and it's a whole other project.
At the time they made Die Hard, Bruce Willis was a TV star because of the TV show he did with Cybill Shepherd called Moonlighting, which was a pretty good ratings hit. But at the time, TV stars did not make movies and were not hired to be leading men in movies. So how was Bruce Willis cast as John McClane?
That is interesting. And Bruce Willis's kind of ascendancy to stardom I found that really fascinating, especially now, because it's really hard to even imagine Bruce Willis before he was Bruce Willis. He's been an icon to us for so long that you can't even imagine him not being a star. But like many actors before him and after him, he was once a bartender on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and kind of made his way through Broadway and eventually got to some TV auditions. And, yeah, he landed a starring role on this show opposite Cybill Shepherd, Moonlighting, which was a hit. There's no question about it. I mean, the ratings were great. The budget that they got for, you know, per episode was at some record high. But, yeah, TV and TV stars, that was a completely different universe and definitely, you know, not the same fishbowl as the movies. I mean, today now it's very different. Everything is content, you know, whether it's on video on demand or Netflix or Hulu or TV or the movies, it's all kind of mixed in the same bag now. But back then, if you were a TV star, you weren't necessarily taken seriously to lead a movie, especially a big macho action movie where buildings are blowing up.
Yeah, even Tom Hanks had trouble at the beginning of his career moving from bosom buddies to going on screen and making things like Bachelor Party. So, yeah, Bruce Willis probably looked at this and went, you know what? I could stay in TV and make a lot of money. But then his agent, Arnold Rifkin, a name I didn't learn until I read your book, he made an incredible deal for Willis, didn't he?
Yeah, so Arnold Rifkin, who was this sort of, you know, he was a big player in the late 80s, early 90s, and this was a time when he was just starting out. He eventually ran the William Morris talent agency in the 90s, but he represented Bruce right when Bruce was at Moonlighting. And when Bruce had finished his first movie called Blind Date with Kim Basinger, which did well at the box office, but it got very poor reviews, and Bruce was working on his second movie at the time called Sunset, which was being made at TriStar, and everyone at the studio knew it was going to stink. There was this moment where Bruce and Arnold, as I understand it, or as Arnold told me, really thought that this could very well be the end of Bruce's career. They thought he might just be, you know, limited to TV only. They couldn't see ahead. He certainly didn't think that he would become what he became. So it was this volatile moment. And meanwhile, at 20th Century Fox, they're developing the script Die Hard, and they have the director, John McTiernan, attached, and they are pitching the script to all the typical action stars. Who, at least in their mind, they pitched it to Schwarzenegger. They went to Pacino. They went to Burt Reynolds. They went to James Caan. They went to Richard Gere, apparently. They went to everybody, and everyone turned it away because it felt like it was some sort of cliched, you know, run-of-the-mill, typical shoot 'em up, and no one wanted to be kind of attached to that. And so Bruce Willis popped up on the radar because he was kind of the only one left. And not only was he the only one left, but it gave Arnold the opportunity to land a really juicy deal for Bruce and get him $5 million for the movie, which was unheard of at that point.
He was the highest paid actor for a couple of weeks, wasn't he?
He was one of the highest paid. I think Stallone and Arnold had made bigger paydays before him, you know, in terms of a TV star landing $5 million out of nowhere at a major studio like that, literally, you know, movie stars were calling their agents the next day. It completely screwed up the ecosystem.
When you say that, do you mean that other guy, it was one of those, well, the high water lifts all boats, so all the other people were saying, hey, if this guy's getting $5 million, I want $10 million.
Exactly. Exactly. One example would be if a guy like a Richard Gere, who's already a movie star in five or six films, and he's proven himself to be a name that people go to the movies for on Friday night and buy their popcorn, you know, he has a right to go, well, if Bruce is getting five, I should be getting seven, and so forth. There was, at the time, Alan Ladd Jr., who was running MGM, and he was this sort of big, you know, honcho, the studio honcho, and he gave an interview to one of the news, may have been the New York Times or Chicago Tribune, I can't remember, but in it, yeah, he talks about how this completely screws up his entire strategy of how to, you know, maintain budgets for stars. So that caused a major problem, but, you know, in Arnold's defense, I mean, he was doing his job. He was being an agent.
Yeah, I mentioned at the beginning of this that it's, you know, John McClane versus Hans Gruber and his other terrorists. And I always say that action movies live or die based on not just the hero, but the villain. You need a great villain, and there's no doubt that Alan Rickman as Hans Gruber qualified, although you also had William Atherton as the reporter, Richard Thornburg, and Paul Gleason as the inept deputy police chief, Dwayne Robinson. They were in there for kind of comic relief, but Alan Rickman as the villain helped to carry this movie, and he wasn't well known before this, was he?
No, this definitely, he made his bones in Hollywood because of this role. At the time, Alan Rickman was, you know, primarily an actor on the London stage, but he was sort of spotted, and it's not clear by whom. I don't know if it was the casting director or if Joel Silver, the producer, sort of had him on his radar, but they brought in Rickman, and he was a very different look for a bad guy, this sort of intellectual who aspired to be almost like on that corporate villain level, the way he would wear his suits, the way he would try to talk business with Takashi before killing him. And in the process of shooting, they tried to teach Rickman how to hold a gun properly. He almost was limp-wristed the way he'd have a pistol in his hand. So it didn't come naturally to him, but he turned out to be this iconic villain. As for the other actors you mentioned, it's funny because going back to the novel, it's the dialogue and the narrative in the novel is very much told sort of in the mind of McClane, or his character's name in the book is Joe Leland, but not important. So the screenwriter had to figure out a way to kind of flesh this movie out, and which was very difficult for him because not only are you working with a novel that, you know, is inside one person's head and only what they see, but Bruce was also shooting Moonlighting at the time and needed a few weeks off to kind of deal with his TV gig while shooting the movie. And so that required the screenwriter to kind of create these other characters and make more of this ensemble feel.
Ah, okay. That helps. Now, I do have one other question I've got to ask you about Alan Rickman, and this has bugged me since the first time I saw the movie. At the end, when Hans Gruber takes the fall off the side of the Nakatomi building, out the window, they undo the watch. Spoiler alert, by the way, for a 28-year-old movie, I don't have to say that. But when Gruber does that fall, it's obviously green-screened. I mean, Alan Rickman isn't taking a huge high fall, and they used him rather than a stuntman. But it always looked fake to me, except for one thing. It looked like Alan Rickman was really scared. Either that, or he's the greatest falling actor I've ever seen. Which is it?
No, it's real. The background's definitely green screened, but that face you see is very real. The stunt coordinator promised Rickman that he would drop him on the count of three, and he ended up dropping him on the count of one.
And how high did they drop him from? Like 5 feet?
No, must have been 25, 30 feet. Or 20 feet, somewhere, and it was high.
So we get a few seconds of that fear in Rickman's face, and it always bothered me because the rest of it kind of looks a little phony because of the green screen, but I knew that's real. That's not acting. That guy's scared.
Yeah, he sold it.
He absolutely did. There are great stories like that galore in this book, which is a wonderful quick read. It's about 70 pages or so. It's available now as the download as a Kindle single for $3. It's called An Oral History of Die Hard, and here's the guy who put it together, Brian Abrams. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Anytime.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.